The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org. Josh Swiller is the author of The Unheard, a memoir of deafness in Africa. He was born with moderate hearing loss and was legally deaf by the age of 4. Josh learned to communicate through sign language and lip reading. Hell-raising was his other survival strategy. After graduating from Yale University, he embarked on a beautiful variety of careers, including forest ranger in the California Redwoods, sheepskin slipper craftsman and salesman, Zen monk, raw food chef, journalist, and teacher. Most recently, he's worked as a hospice social worker in Brooklyn. He was a Peace Corps volunteer in rural Zambia, and after that, he traveled throughout Africa, Europe, and Asia. All in all, he notes, I visited or lived in 24 countries and owned every album by Van Morrison by the time I was 27. He is not impressed, I might mention, by when we Angelenos talk about what a rough winter we had this last year, so don't go there with him. I would now please join me in welcoming Josh Swiller to the Los Angeles Public Library. Josh, welcome.
Thank you.
Really been looking forward to this.
Hard to live up to that introduction.
Well, you grew up in a, sounds like a very rambunctious family with three brothers, one of whom was deaf, is that correct?
It is. And I think rambunctious is an understatement.
It's an understatement. Well, how much of an understatement is that?
I would say the fifth brother was a police sergeant who came to the house often to keep us in order. Now, that's a little bit of an exaggeration. But when you can't hear, a very good way to get your point across is by hitting.
And also, apparently, by putting grapes up your nose. Is that true?
That, too. Although, it's not a very good point to make.
It's not a very... Well, you were raised in a household that, in a sense, was so busy and rambunctious, and you had special classes to learn to lip read. So that way you had kind of individual instruction in lip reading. Is that correct? How did that work?
Yes. You make a good point. Part of how I was able to do all these things was I was raised not to think that... deafness was something terrible or special or something that could would hold me back, that there was plenty of other things wrong with me that I should take care of. But I did have a wonderful speech teacher. I had 12 years of almost daily speech therapy and lip reading training, and that really made a difference.
But the flip side of that was that, in a sense, what startled me was you said your family, in a certain way, didn't know how deaf you were. I mean, you have, it's a genetic problem, right, that you and your brother have, the deafness.
Yeah. Being raised mainstream deaf is a tricky thing because part of how you succeed is by not letting people know how deaf you are. Or at least that's how it appears to be. And so you learn these techniques for, you know, smiling and nodding and pretending you got it. And I had my cousin, who is also one of my cousins, also has a hearing loss. He has what he called the three-time rule, which was if someone said something and he didn't get it, he would pretend, he would ask three times to repeat what the person said. And then if he still didn't get it, he would just smile and nod. For me, it was more like the one-time rule. But it was just about not really overcoming deafness, but fighting through it.
Yeah, I think you described, you said it was that you had 70% lip reading boosted your hearing from 20% to 70%. And in terms of what did 70%, what was it like?
Well, 70% was ideal. I mean, you have mustaches, you have foreign accents, you have foreign accents and mustaches, and Mrs. Meerbergen, my seventh grade English teacher, who was a woman and had a foreign accent and a mustache, and all of these things, 70% was ideal.
But it was hard work.
It was hard work. I've never, to this day, understood a word Bob Dylan has said, you know.
And you said, and Adele, your lip reading instructor, said he should be ashamed of himself for his.
Should be.
He doesn't enunciate.
Should be. He does not.
He does not enunciate. And at Yale, then you went on to Yale, and doesn't sound. I know you described one professor with a big furry beard, and he was your philosophy professor. You learned. Mm-hmm. You got nothing from him, right?
Yeah.
But you still got a B plus.
I still got a B plus. This is a little known fact in philosophy classes. If you ingest certain chemicals and then just write the same sentence over and over again, just a little bit of a difference, that's a B plus.
It's a philosophy paper.
That's philosophy.
But it sounds like you developed a pretty well-honed philosophy, kind of existential philosophy of your own. I mean, you went off and did your own reading of, like, Nietzsche. What else were you reading there?
I did. I mean, because growing up deaf, you kind of have a space between you and the world. And you're in a lot of situations where you're not really hearing what's going on, but you're observing people's body movements. You're observing their affect. And it's a totally different way of looking at the world. Imagine, like, you're in a law firm and you see people and you don't understand what they're saying. Excuse me. I had like 2 cups of coffee. But you don't understand what they're saying, but maybe they're talking about freeing someone from death row. But it looks like they're just yelling at each other. Mm-hmm. It looks like mm-hmm. they're angry with themselves and angry with life. And so for me...
The mic a little closer?
A little closer. Sorry about that. It's kind of fitting. No one can hear me. But it's... lost my train of thought.
We like an outspoken audience.
It's that distance for me, and I think I speak for a lot of people raised as I was, it really makes you question a lot of things you're supposed to take for granted, of what success is, of what you're supposed to do in life.
Well, I think this kind of leads into... I mean, you always were someone, apparently, who asked a lot of questions, disturbed people even with your questions. And I know when you were watching your colleagues at Yale go off to graduate school in law and in medicine, there was a phrase you said, what did ambition matter if we're all going to die? Which is a very good question, you know. And that was seemed
it's
to
also
be
also a good reason to, you know, get stoned and watch MTV.
And perhaps to join the Peace Corps and go to Zambia.
Right, exactly. Or go to Zambia. But that reminds me of something that happened with Zev growing up. Because I started... Zev is my brother who's here today, which is a great great thing for me to share with him. And he said he would beat me up if I mentioned his name, so I have to do
let's
it as soon as
possible.
Let's mention
it a lot. Yeah, let's Zev. Do it. Let's talk about Zev exclusively.
So... we were growing up, and we were watching the big show of the time, which was Cheers, and this was before closed captioning. So he was watching it with my father, and they were laughing at everything. And I said to my father, "This isn't fair. Why do you get to hear? Why does Zev get to hear?" And my father said, "Everyone has their burdens, Josh." And I said, "Really? What's your burden? What's Zev's burden?" Now, my father didn't say anything, even though he'd been through a lot. And Zev didn't say anything, but he just pointed at me.
Your family had quite a sense of humor. Your father, what did he call the George Washington Bridge? He told you it was the...
George Washing Machine Bridge.
And he was father of our...
Father of our laundry. Yes.
That's really toying with you.
Yeah. Yes, I only figured that out a year ago.
Yeah. you know, when you were describing that, and we'll talk about that some more, your description of the feeling of being outside of what's going on. This book is a remarkable, I mean, I'm sure it is for deaf people who read it, for myself as well. It's such a way into a world. I mean, you have such a marvelous language. You're very gifted with metaphor. It's really a beautiful book. I really, really loved it. Let's talk about your decisions and what led up to your going to the Peace Corps in Africa, which does not seem to be a likely trajectory for someone who's deaf.
My family would say anything that seemed like a likely trajectory, I immediately said, I'm not doing that. But growing up, like I said, I was in the world but not in it. And I was playing it, being hearing, and never getting it. And so after I finished college, I went to Gallaudet University, which is the National University for the Deaf, and it's in Washington, D.C., and I thought, maybe here, where there are all these other deaf people, where everyone's signing, where we have a shared common bond, I will find this deep connection.
And let's insert here that until that time, aside from your brother and a cousin, mm-hmm. you had never not only not hung out with other deaf people, you didn't know other deaf people. Is that correct?
No. Yeah, except for my father when I asked him for help with my homework. But, I had no idea, really, that this world was out there.
And what was Gallaudet like for you?
Well, in some ways, it was amazing. And it's a place I continue to have a relationship with. Signing community is an astonishingly open and beautiful and embracing community. But it also has its defensive side. And to the people there who were deaf, I wasn't really deaf because I could talk and I could read lips. So to hearing people, I was deaf, and then to deaf people, I was hearing. Hmm. So nowhere I went felt like I could fit in. So to me, the obvious thing was to go to Africa.
So it was about finding a place where it was either fitting in, or was it the fact that your deafness would be, in a sense, irrelevant? Was that the hope that you had?
That was the hope. That makes it sound more thought out than it was. But that was the hope, to go someplace where experience was so intense and immediate that it made deafness irrelevant. Yeah.
Now there, so you got there and you had your hearing aids in. Had people there seen hearing aids before? Were they used to people? What did they think they were?
Well, when I was out in the village, which is not where I was, first I was at training, but right. when I was in the village, people there had never seen a white person before. So that kind of superseded that I was wearing hearing aids. And maybe they thought, you know, all white people wear these weird earrings. All white people say what a lot. All white people, you know, when you ask them how you're feeling, they say, yes, the weather's nice. Things like that. But I really did find in the village a place past deafness. Because this was a place, like, people did not talk over each other. People always looked right at you when they spoke. That was the culture. People, generally, English was not their first language. So if they were talking English to me, they took their time and spoke very slowly. Mm. And generally, there weren't many white people there. So if there was a group, they really wanted to make sure I understood what was being said. And so for the first time, I felt like I found a place where deafness was irrelevant. And that's where my trouble started.
You said it so beautifully in the book. You said, we were talking about one of the constants in my life was being marginalized. You said at Manunga, I was right in the fray. I think mm-hmm. that really describes what then ensues. But before we get to the village, during your training, you came upon a class for the deaf. Could you tell us a little bit about that? What was the extent of deaf education in Zambia that you encountered?
Blink and you miss it. The deaf education was they took the deaf children and put them in a room and ignored them for the rest of the day. So they became very good soccer players, but they didn't really get a chance to learn any language. And I stumbled on
this
class.
Wasn't there a teacher there? I mean, what was he
doing? It was a teacher, but he had no oversight. He was the only hearing person in the whole city of 500,000 who knew any sign language. So he could do what he wanted. He had no...
Did the kids learn to sign? I mean, were they...
The kids did learn to sign. The kids... Zambia speaks... deaf people in Zambia mostly speak American Sign Language with some home signs mixed in. To give an example, our sign in American Sign Language for America is this, the great big melting pot. And their sign for America was this, which is our sign for army. A little different. And to give another example, our sign for a young woman in America is young woman, like shoulders back and happy, young woman. An old woman is old woman, long beard. And their sign for young woman was, an old woman was. Very different.
So those are their home signs? I mean, those are the, what kind of the slang of the...
Was that slang? Well, you know, in Zambian culture, where in the villages where, I mean, when you had five or six, and you were a woman, a mother, and you had five or six children, you were just getting started. And so breasts were not sexual. People were, breastfeeding one baby after another. And I'm not killing this. This can sound gross, but I've seen women breastfeed their babies that were strapped to their backs. Mm. So think about that for a second. Mm. But what was I going to say? But in Zambia, the skin from the waist to the knee was on the woman was considered extremely sexual.
Thus, the Playboy swimsuit edition was...
The Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue.
Yep, Sports Illustrated, right.
Yeah.
Very precious to young men.
It's very precious. Yeah. But you could be in the cities, women were stoned to death for wearing short skirts. Mm. And so then when my father sent me the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue, I really shot up in the eyes of the men and the children in the village.
Tell us, just before we leave this deaf classroom in Zambia, how did the kids relate to you? I mean, here you were, a deaf person who could speak. That must have been very startling to them. Did it give them a lot of hope?
It was actually, to be honest, it was really heartbreaking. In a way, I gave them a false hope. Mm. They saw me, they saw my hearing aids, they thought, oh, if I get one of those, I can be just like you. But it's not the case. Deafness is not just not hearing. It's also a language vacuum in a way. It's also everyone around you is conversing and you're not getting that.
I think there's a passage that would be good to read about that, about the classroom.
Yeah, this kind of sums up what we were just talking about. The first half dozen years of life are the most crucial in education. The child's brain is hungry and flexible. It can learn dozens of words a day in several different languages just through overheard conversation. But deaf children, unless there's timely diagnosis and coordinated support, barely learn any language during that time. Such support is almost unheard of in Africa. Too late, the parent stares at the child and thinks, why won't he say anything? By then, the fertile years for learning have passed. The mind is hardened around the absence of language, and the child, without ever knowing otherwise, is remaindered to a lesser kind of life. He can't understand everyone talking around him, and only by demeaning and undignified gesticulations can he convey even the simplest ideas to people, who then assume that he's retarded. They give him a hoe and send him to the fields, or they give him a broom and send him to the corner. At night, they give him a glass of banana wine, and he sits quietly against the wall and watches lips soundlessly move.
Yeah, that whole section was really heartbreaking.
It was. But there have been some improvements. I'd like to, throw in something positive. One thing that's happening now is... a company in Botswana, which is right next to Zambia, has developed solar-powered hearing aids.
Wow.
And
oh, fantastic.
Yeah, and all the work is done by deaf people, the soldering and stuff, and all the marketing and PR is done by deaf people. And it's now in 5 countries. And I think that's a great program. But by and large, it is
a heartbreaking
story.
Can we support it? I mean, it sounds like a great company to know more about.
Yes, it is. It's if you go to my website, there's...
That's a great website.
JoshSwiller.com. There's a page about getting involved.
Great.
And the company is called Godisa.
Great. Yes. Great. So let's talk about your time in Africa. So here you show up in this village, and I think your Peace Corps, you know, your mission is to
dig wells
or get the villagers to dig wells. How are you going to go about that? You don't know the language, or you know a little bit of the language. You need allies. How do you start? How does one start?
Well, I started the way I learned growing up, which was picking fights.
That sounds useful.
No, it actually wasn't.
Could you talk about that, Josh?
Zambia, Bemba, which was the tribe where I was, has a culture with a lot of deference. You did not confront people directly. If you had an issue with someone who was older or more superior in power, there was a technique called the snake in the grass, where you approach them like a snake, you know, slithering around, getting to your goal. And growing up with Zev and my other brothers, I had the approach of straight right, followed by left hook, which was not so good. But when I saw things that were wrong, mm-hmm. that people were not getting the water they needed, that they were being stopped by community leaders from organizing in the way they needed to, I was a little too more confrontational than I should have been.
But those leaders could be also be very dangerous if you cross them as you learn. Maybe we could read some passage about that. But first, I just want one of your main allies there, very soon after you got there, there was a remarkable man who was the doctor in the clinic there. Tell us a little about Jer.
Mr. Jer, before I get to that, you just reminded me about the leaders being dangerous. Mnunga is infamous in Zambia for having a lot of witch doctors.
Why did they send you to Mnunga then?
Because we were the first group to go to the country.
I see.
They knew nothing about Zambia. They just drove around in their jeep before we got there and said, hey, this looks like a nice place. I mean, I know we expect, you know, our government to be really well organized, but surprisingly. But an interesting story is just a couple months ago, some people who in Zambia now in the Foreign Service who read the book told me they were in Mnunga, and I asked them, oh, how is it? Has it changed? And they said, you can buy lightning at the market. So I think it still hasn't changed. There's still that witchcraft.
Whoa. There were some very, very heavy incidents that happened that Josh describes in the book. But first tell us about, because you need an ally to get you through these.
I need an ally, and it was banana wine. No, wait.
It was banana wine and?
I met this man. I was really blessed. His name was Augustine Jerry, and really just about the most remarkable person I've ever met. And here in, you know, this village in Africa where everyone is struggling to survive and where everyone is scraping to get more and to get what they can, he'd come to Mnunga to serve. He was very idealistic. He was very bright. He taught me to play chess. And the way he taught me was we'd set up the board and he wouldn't look at it. He would just lie down and I would move the pieces and I would lose. And he just, his heart was always in the right place.
Josh, part of his idealism, you should tell people, was that because he was working outside of his tribal area, he was working not just for his tribe. Yeah. Instead of for his tribe, he was working for the good of the country, right? That, which you said was quite remarkable also.
Yeah, you know, I said that most people in the village hadn't met a white person. I would say most people hadn't met someone outside their tribe.
Mm-hmm.
And Zambia was formed on some table in Germany. It really had nothing to do with the natural boundaries of the tribes. Excuse me. And Jerry was from a tribe in the south. Hmm. He went to clinic worker school. And they asked him, where do you want to go? And he said, send me where the need is greatest. Wow. And they were not used to that answer. And I think they were a little insulted by that answer. You know, it made them look at what they were doing, which was mostly, send me where I can get the most bribes. And so they said, okay, we're going to send you to Manunga.
Wow. And so what was life like at the clinic? I mean, what did his work consist of doing? Did he have an arsenal of medicine that he could... I mean, people were sick a lot.
Yes. There was really... It was a banquet of tropical diseases. Malaria, meningitis, AIDS. If you just got a cut on your arm and didn't take care of it within like a week, you'd have a big sore. Once I had a cut on my big toe, and I kind of ignored it until a week later, two little flies crawled out of it. And just, you never knew what would happen. But he did not, there were really no medicines.
There were no medicines.
No, there was no electricity, so there was no way to refrigerate anything. So like if someone came in, one time someone came in with a regular heartbeat, and Jerry called me over to feel this young man's pulse, and it was like feeling a bee trapped in his wrist. And I was like, oh, my God, what are you going to give him? And he said, an aspirin and a Valium. And I'm like, an aspirin and Valium? That can't be enough. And he's like, look, I'll sleep without a headache. And that was about all we could do.
Would you read the passage from the rains about the children? This was another part of the health situation in the town.
Yes. To give a little background while I look for the page. Yeah. When I got to Manunga, it was the dry season. And during the dry season, disease does not spread as much. The mosquitoes are not out. And then when the rains hit, everything changes instantly. After weeks of ominous thunderclouds, one October afternoon a cloud opened and rain poured, glittering in the sun like sequins on a dress. The dirt yards of the village, choked with dust for months, immediately flooded and rutted with fast-moving streams. Children stopped what they were doing and ran in ecstatic circles. Malama and Palije set my slipper down a flood stream roaring behind the latrine. It took off like a shot, and we never saw it again. The forest grew six shades darker. Maize seedlings shot up 6 inches a day. Banana trees grew so fast, they tipped over. Each evening, bullfrogs called out for their wives with desperate insistence. There was so much new life. Then overnight, children started dying in droves. Mosquitoes arriving on the heels of the first downpour brought meningitis and malaria, and the youngest and weakest were hit hard. Villagers shuffled from funeral to funeral like shackled prisoners, dividing their grief into ever smaller fractions. They huddled near each funeral fire, the men in one clump, the women in another. The women took turns to stand up and wail, but the men never stirred until it was time to head to the next ceremony. I was often asked to come and sit for a while, and so I did, and we all sat with our thoughts of life and death. Did they believe that death was the end or just the beginning? Did they believe souls we cured? I rued the arrogance of feeling at home in a place where people fought daily just to survive. The whole energy of the town became muted, and I sunk into the background. At night, funeral fires dotted the darkness like traffic signals for ghosts.
And Jer lost his daughter that season, right?
He lost his daughter actually the next raining season, and
from meningitis or
from malaria, and
a daughter he was very close with.
Most people there, most parents, they didn't see their children. They didn't have the same closeness we have with their children here, which makes sense when there's like a 1 in 3 chance your child won't live to be 5 years old. To form that kind of emotional connection would just be too painful. But Jerry did. And his daughter was very protective of him, and they had a really beautiful relationship. And she passed away.
You were also called upon, I thought it was a really remarkable passage, there was a young boy who was dying of meningitis, you said this skinny man appeared and asked you to come basically be a healer. Tell us what went on. I mean, why did he think you were a healer?
Well, I mean,
you worked at the clinic.
I worked at the clinic, and they saw what they knew of white people was, you know, we invented cars, planes, shoes, all these things they'd never seen. And, you know, we could live forever. We had medicines to heal everything. We never got sick. So sometimes people would get very sick, and their family would get it in their head. The white man, with his white medicine, he can save them. And really, all I had was a couple of Band-Aids and aspirin. And it was a real humbling lesson. I mean, it seems belittling to say it was a lesson. Someone else is dying, but
what really drew me to that particular passage was you talked about talking to this dying young man in your head, which was something that you were very practiced at, being deaf. Mm-hmm. Can you explain that?
Well, he had meningitis, and he was
which destroys the
half his body was paralyzed and half his body wasn't, and he was lying on the ground. And meningitis is a really high fever, and it's a very common cause of deafness, because what it does is it melts the hearing nerves, not melts the hair cells in the ear, which are very sensitive. And he was lying there, and, you know, sometimes all you can do is say, you know, I'm sorry for this.
But you said, I think this relates to where I was kind of thinking about this, was when you talked about how, in a sense, being deaf can lead to a sense of, you said one of the great things about deaf culture is that absent constant background noise, people are alone with their thoughts a lot, which I think fosters a natural empathy. And I really thought about that in that passage, because it seemed like what you were doing was really...
I think so. I mean,
being empathetic, which was in a sense a very healing act, with, you know, it's what you could do for that young man.
I think so. I think when I mentioned the beauty of deaf culture, and I think that's part of it, that the people have this shared wound. You know, you walk around all day and everyone's talking in a language you can't, and you can let it destroy you, or you can use it to try to come to a deeper understanding.
Now, I don't want to give away some of the truly amazing incidents that happen in this book, but there was you did kind of get out of there with your life intact, just barely at one point. Maybe there's a little part of that scene you could set up for us, when there's basically... Josh and Jer are holed up in a room, and there's a mob coming. And you've seen what mob violence can do in Manunga. It's not a pretty sight.
No, it's not.
I mean, you were seriously fearing for your life.
No, it was like, you know, a Van Halen concert.
Can you read the part about when the group is coming towards the room, towards the clinic, where you are? You know, you're in your house. You're in your hut.
Do you mean the part feeling the mob coming?
Yeah.
Okay. This is this happened in the middle. There were mobs all the time. This was my first mob.
First mob.
And I can give away a little more of the story, I guess. But here in America, when someone 100 years ago in the Wild West, if someone stole a cattle, the posse would go after him and string him to death and kill him. And that's how they kept order, because there was no policemen. There was no army out there. And I think that's a good metaphor for how it was in the village in Africa. The army was useless. There was no police. So if someone broke the law, justice was immediate. And very violent.
And often stoked by alcohol, too.
Yes, there was one boy who had his leg cut off for stealing a fish, one fish. And then there was one man who, in a kind of drunken accident, killed another man, which set up this whole cycle of violence and this mob.
And it's a pretty amazing description. It really is.
Yeah, I know. You know, when I tell these stories, and I'm thinking, it wasn't really amazing when I was there, but I was man, Friday, Malama, who lived on my couch, woke me up early and he said, "You gotta see this. This is amazing." And I'm like, "What?" He's like, "We caught the bad guy and we're dragging him to death." It's like, "Okay, I'll go see that." But and we get to the market and nobody is there. And so then one thing about deafness is you come to develop an intuition based on physical observation. Body language, posture, motion, expression reveal so much. The loneliness in the way a woman waves goodbye. The anger in how a man opens and closes his fist. People are open books. They give their secrets away every moment. And how they study the reflection. How they check the time. Thing was, that moment when the parade of villagers came over the hill, their energy, the energy I sensed before I saw or heard them, that energy was clean. It felt like happiness. It always did strike me. You think mobs are angry, but they're actually really joyful.
Yeah, that was so shocking when you talked about that. There's kind of joy at accomplishing, you know, what they set out to do, which was to
justice. Know,
justice, yes.
Yep.
I was wondering if, when you talked about, you know, being comfortable with the thoughts in your head, do you think that's something that's really aided you as a writer? Because you have this wonderful fluidity in your writing. Do you think there's a relationship there between having been alone and sort of kind of practiced at writing?
I think my family would argue him comfortable with the thoughts in his head. I think it's a continuing process to always find peace in yourself, find peace with your thoughts. And I definitely think deafness is a great teacher for that. Did it aid in writing? I don't know. It definitely helped when I needed peace and quiet. I could always turn off my hearing aids and get to work.
Well, now that you have a cochlear implant, do you return to that silence? Can you turn it off? Can you turn off the sound?
Yeah, especially when people ask me to wash the dishes. Yeah, I can turn it off. A cochlear implant, for people who don't know so much about them, hearing aids take sound and amplify it, send it through the ear. An implant takes sound and turns it into computer code, ones and zeros, binary code, and send it directly to the brain up to 80,000 times a second. So it's a completely different kind of hearing. And it improved my hearing 600%.
Well, first of all, you should say that you had lost, your hearing aids were no longer working for you.
Yes, they were not working. 30 years of just blasting amplified sound had worn out my ears.
And that was when you went to Gallaudet, was at that point?
That was, yes. In that really rambling kind of life story you told at the beginning, about 5 years ago, I lost the rest of my hearing. And I went back to school, not at Gallaudet, but in New York, and worked at a school for the deaf, and really got to know the deaf community. But then I found out about implants, and I thought, I got nothing to lose. I'll try this. And it's about the best decision I ever made.
Mm. I know that people are going to want to ask Josh a lot of questions. We wanted to maybe end our discussion here with reading a passage. Maybe we'll come back to that even after the questions. Is there anything else you want to read before we open up to questions?
Something comes to mind, I will read it. But actually, I would like to read that now, the passage you're referring to. People ask, so what was the point? So what did you learn? So where do you go from here? And not to give it all away, and I don't think I am, this paragraph kind of sums it up for me. And This paragraph takes place while Jerry, this friend, and I are waiting in a hut with handmade weapons, while outside a mob is throwing rocks in the windows and swearing justice. Sort of like going to a Nick game. That night, so this is after the danger has passed and everyone's gone to sleep. That night, I was in love with the sunrise before it came. Nothing was lacking. When you've been waiting for death to ram through the door, every additional minute feels more precious than all the diamonds in Zaire. It struck me that maybe this was what I'd come to Africa to learn. Not to save lives, not to exchange cultures, not to understand deafness or escape deafness or embrace deafness, just to be grateful for each moment. I saw that even the horror, the complete horror of Africa, spreading over the continent, hacking off limbs and heads, has an opposite, and that opposite is a grace so profound that I still, many years later, have no words for it.
It's so beautiful. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll open it up to questions. We'll wait till the microphone comes around. While you think of it, I just wanted to ask, Richard Kapuscinski was a big, you really love his work, don't you? And if people haven't read him, he's also a great writer on many things, but on Africa, he's...
He just recently passed away last year.
Yeah.
Polish journalist, I think, he started out, who spent 50 years pretty much traveling around Africa and telling it straight.
Yeah, I really recommend his work as well. Do we have questions in the house? There's one back there. Oh, right there.
Has your book gone to your friends in Africa? And if so, how have they reviewed or perceived your book as a reflection of their own lives back at them?
Has the book gone to your friends in Africa? Have they been able to read it?
I don't want to give away too much, but I guess I have to. But first of all, most of my friends in Africa wouldn't be able to read, which is why I think we should make a movie. Wouldn't be able to read it. But call me if you... But my good friend, Augustine Jerry, when it finally came time for us to say goodbye, I was so shooken up by the prospect. I mean, I just couldn't believe it. I wouldn't see him again, uh-huh. That I could ever come back to a place where you can get, you know, coffees and everything, where you can drive cars, play video games. It just seemed totally unreal. So he was like, he wanted to stay in touch. I'm like, of course we'll stay in touch. I'll be back next week. But I couldn't make it back. And I fell out of touch with him for 10 years. Mm. And I tried through newspaper advertisements, through letters, through everything to find him. And because he was a lot like me, confrontational and stubborn, I was very worried for years if he was still alive. And then, thankfully, through this book, which I dedicated to him, by the way, through this book, I was able to, last December, to get back in contact with him, which is one of the best things that's come
from
it.
That's fantastic. So he's read it then?
No, he's not read it yet. I sent him one copy. It didn't get through in the mail. I sent him another, but he'll read it.
Okay. Right here? Hang one second, just for the... Wait for the microphone. Thanks.
Oh, okay, fine. Do you have a special iron constitution? Did you boil water? Did you eat exactly all the native food, etc.?
I was supposed to do those things. I think, you know, it's hard to boil water every meal. They did give us water filters. My brother Zev came to visit.
Yeah, I wanted you to read that part about standing in the river. That was...
Okay, maybe I'll read
that. He also was supposed to avoid the river.
My brother Zev came to visit, and he said, you know, one of the things I was doing, it wasn't just digging wells, but it was teaching about water sanitation, about how you can prevent diseases by you know, drinking clean water and washing your hands. And he was like, you talk about water sanitation and you never wash your hands.
And you were also supposed to avoid going in the river because of a terrible disease.
Yeah. Schistosomiasis.
And there's a great scene of taking your brother in the river.
Yeah, there's a drug for it now, but it wasn't then. There wasn't then. And schistosomiasis is a little larva that goes into, what do you call them, your special parts. And it goes into them, and then it blooms in your bladder. And it was considered a rite of passage in the village when you went from peeing urine to peeing blood because it was so common. So I said, Zef, now you're here, let's go swim in the river.
What you put up with, I don't know. Do you have that passage marked though about standing in the river? That's really a good one.
All right.
He's in hiding. Yeah. No, there he is, right there. He survived.
All right. Okay, where to start this? Finally, he was here. We hugged each other tightly. You smell, he said. He shrugged off his pack, introduced himself to Malama and Chaluba, then went to bed and slept for 14 hours straight. When he woke up, Chaluba brewed him a pot of bush coffee, acrid, paint-peeling stuff. Then Malama and I took him to our favorite place for a swim, a secluded spot where a row of water-loving Musondo trees grew right in the middle of the river and met other trees overhead to form an intimate canopy. The seclusion of the place made it, theoretically, perfect for a croc ambush, which was probably why there were never many bathers there. But you couldn't worry about that. There were so many ways to die in Manunga, it was pointless to fixate on just one. While you scanned the water for crocs, a black mamba could come up behind you and bite you on the ass. If you didn't pull it off within 5 seconds, it would pump enough venom to down a hippo. Or maybe a mosquito carrying cerebral malaria was probing your neck at this very moment, and schistosomiasis larvae were slipping up your veins toward your intestines and the tunnels they would eat there. Or maybe some flesh-eating bug was in the goat meat you'd eaten the night before. Ebola, even. Come to think of it, the meat had been sitting in the sun all day at the market before Chaluba brought it, and it tasted kind of funny. Point is, if the water was cool, it was best to enjoy it.
That's a really great passage.
It's true. But the other thing I did was when I went swimming, I always brought 4 or 5 boys from the village with me because I figured they could be appetizers if the crocodile came and I could.
You also talk about this wonderful kind of inappropriate sense of humor that developed in your time in Manunga. Question back there.
I loved your book. I loved your book. Could you speak a little bit more about when the women would bring their babies in to be weighed? You write in your book about when the women bring their babies in at the clinic where you would weigh them. Could you speak a little bit more about that? I thought that was very moving.
One of the things we did at the clinic was 2-3 times a week, we had something called baby weighing, where we had a produce scale, and we put the babies on it and made sure they were gaining weight at the appropriate rate. And one thing that was very different about their culture and ours was in ours, if a baby is not gaining weight, is not looking healthy, we get it more care. We get it, you know, more food, we take it to doctors. But in theirs, if a baby was doing very poorly, they would give it less. And their thinking was, you know, I have 4 or 5 other kids. I only have so much food. This child probably won't make it. Why waste good food on him? And in a way, you know, I mean, it sounds terrible, but, I mean, we couldn't really fight that.
Jer was pretty angry with one of the mothers, though, who brought in twins.
I mean, people would come to the clinic with 2-year-old babies that weighed less than 5 pounds and thinking it's, you know, kind of funny. And he would just lose it and yell at them. and tell them, you know, you should have brought this child here earlier. This is not appropriate.
But some of the mothers were practically kids themselves, right? I mean, they started having children so young.
Younger than Juno. Yeah. They started like 13, 14, and they had as many as 13, 14 children.
Mm. Other questions right here?
I was wondering how you handled coming back after
Good
your
question.
Years in the Peace Corps. Was it hard?
I think my brother would say he's still weird. But I came back, and I have to say, honestly, American culture made absolutely no sense to me. I remember I was talking to a friend who I hadn't seen in 2 years, and I said, so how are you doing? And she said, oh, I'm doing great, except I brought this new couch, and I really don't like it. And I was like, I really can't relate. So 3 weeks after I got back, I was at a Zen center in upstate because I knew where it was quiet, I could get some peace. And I spent about 3 years there, and then I had to recover from that. But it was the right place, and it was a great, good place to be because I got there and I said, nothing makes sense. And the teacher was like, ah, wonderful.
Is that where you became the raw foods cook?
Yeah, in the summer we had raw food retreats, which means we staked people to the lawn and let them have all the grass they wanted. But raw food cook sounds better.
But when did you, so how did the coming back, you know, when did you make the decision to go into hospice work? And was that influenced by your time in Africa?
It was. Yeah, I saw a lot of death when I was there. I mean, of the clinic staff of like 5 people when I got there, Jerry was the only one alive when I left. Mm. I had people die in my arms, people die in the seat near I was. And it's something that I was, you know, as you pointed out, grappling with even before I got there. And to me, hospice work, people say, oh, that must be so depressing. But to me, it's so uplifting. I mean, not always, because a lot, you know, when young patients come in, it's very heartbreaking. But to see people at the end of their life looking back on it and finding forgiveness and thankfulness and, healing relationships that have been broken for a long time, there's no better work. I mean, it could pay better, but really that's...
Well, it seems so connected to what you read about, you know, every moment, you know, and...
I try to remember, you know, to be grateful for every moment, and I would say about once a week.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. I think
that's
you're right
good.
Up there.
Yeah, I think that's
good.
A start.
Another question right there.
Good evening. Thank you very much. I'm very impressed. You seem like a very capable man, and that leads to my question. Today, do you consider yourself to be disabled, or your hearing impairment to be a disability and something that, what's the word I was thinking? Just, something in your life that, just a disability, rather than maybe just an alteration, something that makes you a little bit more unique and different than others, and you consider yourself to be as capable and, you know, not disabled and as capable of the man or the woman next to you?
It's a good question. Yesterday I went to the Echo Horizon School. I see some teachers from there. And Echo Horizon is a school of about 280 students from kindergarten to grade 6, and they have about 25 implanted and deaf children. And they fold these children into the regular classes. And I think one of the great things about that is not just that, you know, it pushes the children to keep up with everyone, but that it really teaches them there's nothing wrong with them. And it teaches the children around them there's nothing wrong with them. It's like in some ways it's no different from having freckles or something. And I think I was able to do the things I did, again, because my parents pointed out I had much worse things going on than being deaf. You know, I mean than Jess, but that was really important. You know, it was never like, oh, it's such a bad thing, you know, it's so, you know, you should have a good cry about it. It was like, eh, get over yourself, rub some dirt in it. So I try not to think that way. And I think it's best not to think that way.
Up there.
Hello. Hi. Okay. Do you think Zambia, or the small village that you spend your life, your time in, do you think that's a good metaphor for Africa? Because as I was reading the book in another...
I'm sorry, what was the good metaphor?
Do you think Zambia, or the small village that you spent your life in, do you think that's a good metaphor for Africa as the continent? Because one of the vexing things in an otherwise beautiful book, as I was reading, you make these extrapolations about Africa, the continent. I mean, Africa is about almost three times as big as this country. There are more than 50 countries. So I think I'm just a little bit confused, and it's a little bit vexing because as beautiful as your book is, most of the things you explain were foreign to me, and I lived in a big city in Africa. Right. And so as you go around, I think just making the point that this is just a small part in Zambia as opposed to saying Africa, I think that would help a lot, actually.
Yeah. No, it's a good point. But when you're like trying to tell a story, you have to cut corners. Like here I am, I'm talking about deafness, and you're probably getting one or two ideas of what deafness is, but it's really many things beyond that. And Africa is the same. I agree. One of the things, you know, people ask me is, you know, what should we do about Africa? Which I think is a very patronizing question. And there are no easy answers, but I think Africa's problems have to be Africa-defined and Africa-solved instead of us going and saying, this is wrong with you and this is how you should fix it.
I think you have a platform, and people are going to be listening to you and asking you these questions sometimes. And I think sometimes I'm finding a way to sort of paint a better picture of essentially how broad of a continent we're talking about, I think would be very useful. And I mean, as my work here as an African physician, I do my best, but I think the books that make it now, the sort of books that sort of promote this primitive, violent Africa, and I think you have a choice to...
Well, one of the things I wanted to get across in the book, and which I hope I can, I mean, we've talked about the dramatic things, which seem really terrible, but the village is actually a wonderful, delightful place to be. Now, there's a saying in Peace Corps, actually, that volunteers who go to South America, they come back politically active and curious. And volunteers who go to Southeast Asia, they come back spiritually aware and curious. And volunteers who go to Africa come back laughing. Because with, you know, everything that happens there, there is an openness and really just a lovely... I mean, again, I'm generalizing too much and I apologize for that. But in where I was really struck by that and tried to get it across in the book.
Yeah, the everyday, you know, feeling of the village, I think, is the specificity that you got across.
Yeah, it's you know.
But it's a good point.
Yeah,
it's a good point. We have a question down here. Just hang on 1 second.
When did you write the book? How long was it from your return, and how long did it take you to write the book, and where did you write it? Talk a little bit about that.
I think it took me almost like 10 years to be in a place to write the book, to sort of assimilate everything. And the hardest part actually was writing about deafness and working that into it. But it was a key part of the story, so it took a long time. I was working at a law firm in New York, and I got fired. I didn't do anything wrong. They were just cutting down. But I took the unemployment and went to a friend's barn in Maine and started writing. And it took altogether about 2.5 years.
Another question down here. And then maybe we'll take one or two after that.
Two questions. One, have you done a movie treatment? Because it would be a fascinating story. And you don't have, I mean, I'm just curious about that. And the other thing is, you're such a beautiful writer. Do you, I would love to see a book from you about America or your work here, because certainly we could use some intelligent, insightful, poetic writing about our country. So if you could answer those questions.
I agree. no, I have helpful cousins in the movie business who are going to work on that side of it. No, it's really, it's been a wonderful ride. This came out in September, and I've had the opportunity to meet so many people, to talk to these organizations that are doing wonderful work overseas and with deaf people here. But yeah, another paycheck wouldn't hurt.
And are you gonna? Are you working on another project?
I am. I'm working on a novel now.
On a novel,
and,
interesting.
It takes place in Asia, actually. Working my way back. My father likes to say the reason I went to Africa was to get any further away from home, I would have had to fall off the face of the earth. So I'm working my way back. So Africa, Asia, and then Westchester.
The last question here. Anyone have another question? Well, Josh, thank you so much for coming and sharing this with us. And I can't recommend it highly enough. Josh will be signing his book in the lobby. And thank you for coming here, and just wishing you all good luck with this story and your next one.
Thank you for having me.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the law firm Arendt Fox. Media support provided by KPCC 89.3 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.